Welcome to the New Books Network Journalism Podcast as The Nation magazine turns 150.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
The distinctive voice of Richard Nixon resigning as president of the United States on August the 9th, 1974. Nixon was brought down by the Watergate scandal and the mysterious Deep Throat, who fed information to Bob Woodward of the Washington Post as the scandal unfolded. Deep Throat's advice to follow the money put Woodward and Bernstein on the trail that eventually led to the president himself. The revelation of Deep Throat's identity in 2005 is one of the events we discuss this week with Richard Kreitner, archivist at America's oldest magazine. To celebrate the nation's 150th birthday, Richard Kreitner is publishing a daily blog on the magazine's website, marking events for each day of the year and how the nation covered them. What did the nation have to say about Helen Keller, Franz Kafka, and the historic D-Day invasion on the beaches of Normandy? We reached Richard Kreitner in New York. The interviewer is Bruce Wark.
Well, Richard, the week starts on May 31st, 2005, when Mark Felt, the former number two man at the FBI, reveals that he was the famous or infamous Deep Throat, the mysterious source who leaked vital Watergate information to Bob Woodward of the Washington Post. The Nation ran a fascinating piece by David Korn and Jeff Goldberg. What did they have to say?
Well, they revealed for the first time, I think, that that Mark Felt had been in charge of the search for Deep Throat back in the early 70s for the FBI. So he was in charge, basically, of finding himself.
Yes, and it's really, I mean, I found the piece so fascinating this many years later. I wonder if you could read an excerpt from Korn and Goldberg's piece.
Sure. The recent dramatic revelation that W. Mark Felt, the former top FBI man who has confessed to being Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein's secret source during the Watergate scandal, has yielded what seems to be the final chapter in the Deep Throat saga, and thus the conclusion to a three-decade-long whodunit, rich in detail, psychology, and irony. But Felt's role as the most famous anonymous source in U.S. history was even more complex and intrigue-loaded than the newly revised public account suggests. According to originally confidential FBI documents, some written by Felt, that were obtained by the Nation from the FBI's archives, Felt played another heretofore unknown part in the Watergate tale. He was, at heated moments during the scandal, in charge of finding the source of Woodward and Bernstein's Watergate scoops. In a twist worthy of Le Carré, Deep Throat was assigned the mission of unearthing and stopping Deep Throat.
The other thing that surprised me, Richard, and about all this, was that Nixon and Haldeman, his henchmen, knew all along who Deep Throat was.
Right, but they just didn't have a way to nab him. Just a little plug, this article is included in an ebook that we published last year of all the nation's coverage of Watergate. It's called Smoking Gun, and it goes from the beginning of Nixon's political career all the way until this article from 2005 and even further, and that's available at thenation.com/ebooks.
Well, your almanac story for June the 1st is pegged to the death of Helen Keller on June 1st, 1968, just short of her 88th birthday. What did you choose from the pages of The Nation about Helen Keller?
Well, for this one, I picked a review of a book by Helen Keller called Midstream, and the review was written by Oswald Garrison Villard, who was the editor and publisher of The Nation, and he's talking about how, you know, we remember Helen Keller, at least I was taught in grade school, that she was, you know, very brave and fought back against long odds, et cetera, et cetera, but she was a really radical and politically committed person.
Yeah, I see that. She was a member of the Socialist Party of America, the Industrial Workers of the World, and she campaigned for many, many progressive causes, including the women's right to vote as well as labor rights. And that, I think, would make her a natural fit for the nation.
Right. Well, I actually have a quote here that she wrote in a letter to Wisconsin Senator Robert M. La Follette when he was running for president in 1924 as a progressive. She wrote, "So long as I confine my activities to social service and the blind, they compliment me extravagantly, calling me Archpriestess of the Sightless, Wonder Woman, and a modern miracle. But when it comes to a discussion of poverty, and I maintain that it is the result of wrong economics, that the industrial system under which we live is at the root of much of the physical deafness and blindness in the world, that is a different matter."
Now, your third story from the week of the first week of June is related to June 2nd, 1924, when Silent Cal Coolidge signed the Indian Citizenship Act. You've chosen a piece the nation ran 4 years earlier. What was that, and why did you choose it?
That was an essay by a very prominent journalist of the time named Elizabeth Shepley Sargent, and she traveled into the Southwest and wrote an essay called "Should the Pueblo Indians Be American Citizens?" I thought it was an interesting piece because it's not responding to the news that Coolidge signed the act, but it's deliberating about the questions that went into the act. And the act granted American citizenship for Native Americans.
And she was arguing in her piece that they shouldn't be granted citizenship.
She was saying that American citizenship would sort of undermine the last vestiges of indigenous culture.
Yeah, and it's sort of hard to place that, isn't it, on the spectrum. I think she advocated that a benevolent protector be appointed instead of immediate citizenship.
She did. As you said, it's very hard to plot her on the political spectrum. It's an interesting argument, not one that we hear too much today, but you can understand the pathos of it, I suppose.
Richard, could you read an excerpt from Elizabeth Shepley Sargent's piece on the Pueblo Indians?
Sure. "The fate of a few thousands of Pueblo Indians will probably arouse very little interest in our many millions. America is a reckless squanderer where small racial units are concerned, and the cause of any Indian race seems a priori a lost cause. Yet justice and the faith of these simple, self-respecting folk in a benevolent Uncle Sam, who has first and last expended considerable sums in providing them with teachers, lawyers, doctors, and farm machinery, should not be lightly set aside. Moreover, if we were going to scrap the Pueblo civilization, consign it to the general Indian ash heap, better have done so in 1846 than in 1921, when there are signs that the greatest and richest country in the world has at last reached the point of creating an American culture. Is there not, on a purely selfish, if not on an altruistic basis, solid reason for conserving and protecting the only Indian race that has, as by a miracle, survived in its original state to the 20th century?"
And that takes us all the way back to 1920, and then we're going to just leap ahead a few years to June 3rd, 1924, the death of Franz Kafka. Let's start, Richard, by hearing an excerpt from a famous novella by Kafka, The Metamorphosis.
"One morning, when Gregor Samsa woke from troubled dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a horrible vermin. He lay on his armor-like back, and if he lifted his head a little, he could see his brown belly, slightly domed and divided by arches into stiff sections. The bedding was hardly able to cover it, and seemed ready to slide off any moment. His many legs, pitifully thin compared with the size of the rest of him, waved about helplessly as he looked. 'What's happened to me?' he thought."
So that's an excerpt from Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis, and you chose from The Nation, June 3rd, 1924, the death of Franz Kafka as your event of the week. What coverage from The Nation did you choose to illustrate Kafka's life?
Well, I chose a review from 1930 of the first work by Kafka to be published in English and translated into English, which was The Castle, translated by Edwin Muir, the poet. And this was a review by Gerald Sykes, who was a philosopher and a novelist and a literary critic.
And could you read a bit from it?
Sure. Interestingly enough, the review was titled "Introducing Franz Kafka," which I like a lot. And this is what Sykes wrote. "In time, much is sure to be written of Franz Kafka, for he is inevitably sure of a place, if only on the strength of this posthumous, unfinished novel, among the foremost writers of our time. On the occasion of his introduction to the American public, however, one can hope simply to recommend him to the attention of that discriminating minority to whom essentially his appeal is limited and who will eventually construct his fame for him. Perhaps it should be stated that Kafka was a German Bohemian Jew and died of tuberculosis in 1925, actually it was 1924, at the age of 42. It is fortunate for his reputation that his work has been championed by two such understanding critics as Herr Broad and Mr. Edwin Muir. Let us hope that they will soon permit us to see the other two posthumous novels, the short stories and the deleted fragments.
One thing that surprised me very much about this review is how it stresses Franz Kafka's religious orientation, the religious themes in his work, and that's something that has kind of gone out of fashion now. We see Kafka, the existentialist, the angst of Kafka, the bureaucratic side of things, the irrationality of bureaucracy, and so on. What do you think about that early interpretation of Kafka as a religious writer?
I think it is very interesting, and I agree that it is kind of gone out of style, but I think that Penguin just published a biography of Kafka in its Jewish Lives series, which kind of refocused on the Judaism. So I have seen actually quite a bit of a renaissance in considering him through that lens.
Now, there were so many events in the first week of June that The Nation covered and commented on. The next one in your blog, The Almanac, was the Chinese government's violent suppression of the student protests in Tiananmen Square. What did The Nation have to say about that? And by the way, that was in 1989.
Right. The Nation published an editorial on that, in which it said, "For now, the party will retain power, but its nakedness has been exposed and it will not easily recover. The popular conclusion to draw, and we are bombarded by it daily, is that this is a further installment in the death of socialism and the triumph of the West. Not so. The Bush administration's discomfiture at Deng Xiaoping's problems speak volumes. The sirens of the West advised China to flood its markets with goodies and the people would be happy. But that was a fallacy, and the students have the evidence. The corruption of the party, which is what has resulted from China's unholy marriage between market reform and an unregenerated, closed political system."
Yes, and there's seems to be foresight in that piece for the decades to come.
Absolutely.
Alfred Lord Tennyson once wrote, "The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends. 'Tis not too late to seek a newer world. I come to you today to say that we can build a newer and better nation. I say we can do so, that we must do so, and that we will do so."
Well, that was the well-known voice of Robert F. Kennedy delivering his famous 'Tis not too late to seek a better world speech only a couple of months before his assassination on June 5th, 1968. Richard Kreitner, what did The Nation have to say about his assassination?
The Nation had been following his career, obviously, for years and the Vietnam War, and I think was quite crestfallen at his assassination. So this is what The Nation wrote in an editorial. "In essence, the single point in RFK's campaign, as in that of Eugene McCarthy, was that America must come to its sense. And in that lies a tragedy that goes deeper than the bullet. It involves the whole situation of the Kennedy clan, of which only one son of Joseph P. and Rose Kennedy now survives. Robert always lived under the shadow of his brother, and much of the acclaim which greeted him wherever he went, and a large part of the votes which would have been cast for him, were an inheritance from the late president. Robert never stood entirely on his own feet, never entirely freed his own abundant talent from the memory of what John F. Kennedy accomplished and might have accomplished had he been spared. And now, in grim turn, we shall never know what Robert might have accomplished. This was not merely Robert's personal problem. It concerned his relations to the Democratic Party and to the country as a whole. It was Kennedy who, in one way or another, gave Johnson the opportunity to involve the United States in a great war on the mainland of Asia, and thus by necessity to ignore all the problems, domestic and foreign, that today beset the most powerful of nations. And it was this whole mindless, cruel drift that Robert Kennedy was determined to stop. He was moved by impulses of the most responsible patriotism, but he was also moved by family. The Kennedys are proud. He would secure his brother's good name by defying, and if possible, defeating, the evil consequences that had flowed from his brother's brutally interrupted administration. And now a bullet has put a stop to that.
One can't hear that without feeling the sadness and the tragedy for not only the Kennedy family, but for the United States in that assassination.
Absolutely. One of the first things I got interested in history in when I was in high school was RFK, actually, and his kind of abbreviated campaign. There's a beautiful, I'm not sure if it's a video or a recording or if I just read about it, but this story about he was campaigning in Indianapolis on the night of April 4th when Martin Luther King was killed. And you know, every city in America basically rioted, but RFK gave this great speech, kind of impromptu, when an aide told him what had happened, and Indianapolis was quiet that night.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization, black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love.
Once again, the voice of Robert F. Kennedy announcing the assassination of Martin Luther King, only months before his own assassination in Los Angeles. Richard, your last entry for the first week of June is for June 6, 1944, the D-Day invasion of France. I noticed that the Nation ran an editorial note later that seems bitterly critical of the domestic politics of the time. What did that editorial note say?
Sure. Well, I think it was probably written by I.F. Stone, who was the Nation's Washington editor then. It was published anonymously, like all editorial notes at the time. But it sounds like him. So this is what it says. The beaches of Normandy are hardly visible from Capitol Hill. Inside the House of Representatives, there is no sound of the Battle of Europe. It is D-Day, but Congress has its own work to do, and it can hardly take time out for history. At first, it seems that the representatives of the American people may turn from partisan politics and match the solemnity of the hour with high action. But the moment passes. Visitors to the galleries have come from their radios, from the headlines, from conversation with a taxi driver whose son is a paratrooper. Now they look down with bewilderment. There are good men down there, good Americans whose sons, some of them, are dying this morning so that Europe and the world may be liberated. But in charge of the debate are the shallow, unseeing men who are converting the tragedy of another fateful day into a tawdry issue of party gain. This is the time-tested game of politics. What day is this? D-Day? What has that to do with us? Our men are landing on the beaches of France, but have they votes in November?
So, that's an editorial note that you think was actually written by I.F. Stone on D-Day.
That's just my guess, but I think it's a fairly educated guess because he was the Washington correspondent at the time, and I don't know, it's just my hunch.
Do you know offhand how long he served as Washington correspondent?
He was with the magazine from, I think, around 1937 until 45 or 46, and then he wrote again later in the 80s, and Washington correspondent, I think, roughly for the duration of the war.
And I guess after The Nation, then it was his own weekly that he founded.
Right. Well, he moved on to PM, which was like a labor daily magazine. And then I.F. Stone's Weekly for around 20 years, I believe. And then he wrote often for the New York Review of Books, and then back to The Nation in the late 80s. One of the few Nation contributors who whose career spans, you know, over six decades at the magazine.
Well, Richard Kreitner, that was a very hectic week, the first week of June in The Nation. Lots of big events there. Thank you very much for joining me.
Sure, thank you. See you next week.
You have been listening to a New Books Network journalism podcast, The Nation Magazine Turns 150. Join us again next week as The Nation's archivist Richard Kreitner talks about how the magazine covered notable events in June. You can read Richard Kreitner's blog, The Almanac, every day on the magazine's website at thenation.com. I'm Claudia Mannion. See you next time on the New Books Network.